I'm Matt Green. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety day is January 26, 1987. And for you newcomers that's here, so you don't miss the rest of me in trying to figure that out, that's 22 years sober. because I did that. You know, listen to speakers, and they throw out dates, so I try to figure out, well, they got sober at this time, and so they got to be this many years sober, and they got to be this old, and, you know, the next thing I know, we're saying the Lord's Prayer, it's like, dang, man, you know. One day sober, walking up on this stage and getting a book, that's absolutely awesome. You know, I pray to God that you find what we found here. It's really uncool to walk up here with one day sober, but that's just, you know, our book says we have to smash that ego. And for me, that was a really hard thing. For me, it's still a constant daily thing I work on. I'd like to thank all of you for having me. There's so many people I met in Washington all over. It seems like everywhere I go in Washington, I talked about that Friday. My kid teases me the way I say that. He says, Dad, there's no R in Washington, I guess. However you say it. But just not in AA. Everywhere I've been in you guys' estate, restaurants, stores, everybody is just so nice. And so it must be really great to even get sober here and live in somewhere in Washington. Now, I have been to Hellhole in Washington, and a bunch of them are here from Omak, Washington, and it's like, Jesus Christ, man. When I got back from there, people said, was there snow everywhere there? And I go, no, none. They go, I thought they had a record snowfall this year. I go, yeah, but it's turned to ice now, you know. And Michael, I want to thank him for staying in contact, and I do this all the time. And they'll ask you, and then sometimes you don't hear from them until the week before the conference, and they'll say, did you get your plane ticket? It's like, oh, you still want me to come? Matt and Mary for picking me up at the airport. Matt passed that on to Mary. That was an adventure getting here. Being most of the way blind and having to go to some gate 00 and nobody's at the counter. It's like, oh man, I don't know where I'm going. I don't know where I'm at. And then a bus shows up to pick us up and there was too many people. And so I didn't get on the bus. And it's like, man, this is... Mari was with me who spoke Friday night. She's an absolute doll. And she goes, well, Matt, we'll just have to trust God. Another bus comes, and another bus came. And then we get to that little tiny model plane airport thing. And they said, well, call your name to get on the plane. Okay, you know, you don't go through no metal detector or nothing, you know. And they called out the names, and me and Mari weren't on that plane either. Oh, shit, you know. Well, might as well go to the bathroom. I asked this guy, I go, do you know where the restroom is? And he goes, well, I'm your pilot. We got to leave right now. I go, man, let's get on that plane and go, man. Don't worry about going to the bathroom once I get there, man. But it was it's been an awesome weekend. Sunday morning spiritual speaker. I'll tell you how spiritual I am. When we got to that model plane little airport thing, you know, they asked us how much we weighed. So they could put the right weight on each side of the seats and stuff. And they asked me, I said 165 pounds. I don't know why I lied about 4 pounds. If we would have crashed, it would have been my fault for lying. It's like, why do we do? I mean, it didn't make no difference, 4 pounds, 169 or 165. After all we ate this week, and when they ask me today, in a little while when I catch up, I'm probably going to have to say 172, you know. I guess if I got the same pilot, I'm probably going to have to make amends to that guy for lying, you know. It's been actually great being here and knowing a lot of people from all the different towns and Ocean View and I've just been all over Washington and Bob, you know, for, you know, I met Bob, you guys' taper, and we've become really good friends over the last couple of years, and we talk a lot. We have some things in common. We talk on the phone about it, and John, for driving up from Fresno, well, he lives in Clovis. Fresno and Clovis are basically, you can't tell the difference in the towns, and he has family up here, so he drove all the way up here to be up here at the conference, and we've gone to a lot of different places together, and I didn't get here in time to hear Kathy. I'm looking forward to hearing her CD, and then, of course, Mari. She's the sweetest thing in the world, and then I've heard about Eva before. We have mutual friends in Santa Barbara and stuff, but I didn't really know her. And to hear her speaking, she did an absolutely wonderful job yesterday. And it was awesome to hear her and to get to talk to her a little bit and get to know her a little bit better. And Chuck, the Al-Anon speaker, you know, I didn't even know they had Al-Anons in Wisconsin. You know, it's like, he's like, man, I got to hear this guy. And he absolutely did a wonderful Al-Anon talk, and I was great. I was so glad that I came to hear him. And I try to make a point of the conferences, all the conferences I go to, that I listen to Al-Anon speakers. You know, and then, of course, Clancy last night. What can you say about Clancy? You know, that's Clancy. Clancy said he's, you know, we're on each other. He's more on me, you know, than I'm on him. But he told me he was going to call me this week after he listened to my CD and critique it. And I said, that would absolutely be awesome, Clancy. And so if Clancy does happen to listen to this, I was in the bathroom a little while ago, and there's this little boy, Ryan, running around here helping. And it was just him and me in the bathroom. And he goes, you know that speaker last night? And I go, yeah. And he goes, I didn't like him. I hope Clancy does listen to it now. And Michael's wife, she's an absolute doll, Melissa, and she had to work today, and she tried everything in the world to get out of work, and she said that she would make Michael get her the CD. So hi, Melissa, sorry you had to work. Everybody gives you all these things you need to say. It's like, man, I can't remember shit, you know. But my youngest child that grew up in sobriety with me, that I got 100% custody of this little child in sobriety, called me a little while ago, and he goes, Dad, don't forget to mention me, and don't forget to mention Casey, you know, and that's my daughter-in-law, and they go with me a lot still. And he goes, and remind me if you mention our name so we can listen to the CD, because he still listens to my CDs. And so I mentioned him, so now I have to tell him he has to listen to CD. And he's not alcoholic, but he's been raised his whole life in sobriety. And he loves still listening to ACDs. And he's a great 12-stepper for us, man. I mean, anybody has any kind of problem, man, we gotta go meet my dad, you know? And I mean, he just brings everybody over, you know? It's an absolute joy, and I have two other children. I have a drug addict, 36-year-old, that absolutely cannot quit, and has a mother that keeps bailing him out over and over and over again. And, you know, he's 36 years old, going back to college now, so mom will bail him and his wife and my two grandchildren out one more time. And I absolutely hate it, but there's nothing I can absolutely do about that. He says the only time he feels comfortable in his life is when he's over my house. He comes over a lot, and there's people at my house all the time. And he goes, when a bunch of your sponsees are sitting around and you're talking to them, he goes, that's the most comfortable I feel in my life. That's the only time I feel safe. And I've gotten him books, and he's listening to tapes, and mom will bail him out one more time, and he just doesn't need it anymore. He might not ever get it. I don't know. That's not my job, you know, to worry about that. You know, I have a daughter that's 32 years old. I didn't know her first 13 or 14 years of life. Judges said I was not, should, my lifestyle, I shouldn't be allowed to be around children. And I found her in sobriety. And making amends, you know, it's like, you know, she kept saying, oh, I understand, Dad. And, you know, when I made the amends to her mom, she kept saying, oh, I understand. It's like, you guys don't understand. I need to do this for me. And, but her mother was sober a year or more than me, and that pissed me off, you know. And, and my daughter, I thought was going to be one of us, and she called me from jail and wanted me to bail her out. And I said, did you learn anything? And she goes, yeah, don't drink and eat acid and drive. Drink and eat acid and stay home. And it's like, wrong answer, kid, you know. And so I didn't bail her out, and that was so hard, you know. I mean, my boys was hard, but my daughter was really hard. And a couple months later, she called me, and she goes, Dad, I'm pregnant. And I go, oh, man, I have to raise this grandchild. You know, in our book, it talks about how some people can abruptly quit and be happy doing that. That was my daughter. My granddaughter will be 14 years old next month, and my daughter's never drank or used since then. I absolutely do not understand that. I think she should have hung in there for a little while longer. I mean, but she has two of my grandchildren, and she leaves those grandchildren with me alone, and God, that's an amazing thing. Anyways, we're supposed to talk about our drinking. I waited a long time before I started drinking. And when I found out, you know, our book says we drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. If I would have known that was the effect alcohol would produce for me, I would have started drinking earlier. But so I didn't start till the summer after the third grade. And and you know, that crap tasted, you know, I guzzled Bacardi around Maxi that morning, and you know, would try to go up and down, and it finally stayed down. And then later on, you know, because it's a little hard to get booze when you're that age. And so I got into the neighbor's hot Thunderbird wine. And Thunderbird wine, you know, in chapter 3 it says drinking natural wines only. I don't think Thunderbird falls under that, you know. I don't think Thunderbird ever had a grape in it, to tell you the truth. I was a shy little kid, you know, and I was afraid, and you know, my hair was so blonde when I was younger, it looked like it was bleached, and I had freckles everywhere, and the kids would pick on me, and I grew up in this little tiny cowboy town, and everybody was married. My parents were the only ones getting a divorce, and I was different, and I was picked on, and so I just got through school every day, you know, so I could get home. I became a daily drinker then. And you know, by the fourth grade, I'm drinking every day, and I'm going to school, and just when I get home, I drink that hot Thunderbird wine, and everything would be okay. The madness was still there, you know, life still sucked, but I could be okay drinking that Thunderbird wine. And I, you know, it was in the first week of school in the fourth grade there, I got to thinking, you know how we think and drink, we should think and not drink, or drink and not think, but we like to mix them two together. And I get to think, if I could, it works so well after school, I wonder what it would do if I drank before school. And I guzzled a bunch of that hot Thunderbird wine, and I went to school, and I whipped four kids' butt on the way to first period class, and I instantly became the tough guy at school. It was an overnight, overday morning success. And that started off a pattern of trying to be on top and trying to keep people away. You see, I never felt like, oh, good, it's morning, I get up and go play. You know, as far back as I can remember, I've done inventories on, I've gone over it with my sponsor, I've done, you know, I've seen a million therapists, psychiatrists, all kinds of whatever, and I never enjoyed life. I never enjoyed getting up and going out and playing, as far as I can remember. Life just sucked, and I don't know where it came from, but I had it all planned in my life. I'm going to die on my 21st birthday, and I'm going to be riding a Harley Davidson. I'm going to be robbing a bank, and when I come out, the cops are going to be out there, and they're going to shoot me, and the news cameras are going to be on it, and I'm going to make it out of there on my Harley shot, and they chase me to the freeway, and I get shot a couple more times, and I get on the freeway, I'm county after county, and now the national news is on it. And several hours later, me and that Harley go end over end, it explodes, and I go out in a blaze of glory, and the whole United States is going to see it. It's going to be an awesome thing. And I don't know where that idea came from either, but I just remember dreaming about that my whole life growing up, you know. And you know, I got into stealing. Nobody had to teach me how to do that either. And if you do things like that, they start doing things like locking you up in juvenile hall. And you do the same thing there when you're full of fear. You know, you can't let anybody know you're afraid. You whip the first kid you come across, and it spreads through juvenile hall. There's this weird, tough guy here. Don't mess with him. And you know, you ended up going to CYA. And I forgot to mention, too, I got hooked up and moved in with the Hells Angels when I was 13 years old, and the night before I turned 13, and that's when I got introduced to those other things we're not supposed to talk about at an Alcoholics Anonymous thing. If you didn't do other things add to your alcohol drinking, you cheated yourself. that stuff can enhance your drinking, like. There's nothing better than seeing 28 closing times at the bar and you ain't been to bed yet, you know. You guys are, I'm afraid I'm going to miss something, you know. And you know, it could be the mother of my next children if I went, you know. when you find out I've been married and divorced 8 times, you probably, you know, what that proves is it wasn't my fault. I kept trying, you know. I don't even remember where I started now. I know I got to catch a plane, so. And I can't go over a CD on Bob. I wouldn't do that to him. Unless you got a second one in there, Bob. I started going to jail like tough guys get to do. And when I first, you know, I wanted to go to jail, like, you know, because Hell's Angels are supposed to do that. You know, it's just part of the daily deal we do. You know, you drink and you fight and you steal and sell things we're not supposed to talk about here. And I was doing an armed robbery and I shot a cop. And I'm sitting in jail. You know, when we get in AA, we don't want to take these inventories. When I get arrested, I'm doing inventories a lot. But it doesn't involve the drinking. It's, you know, the cop's fault. Or like that time, if I ever get out of this mess, I'm not going to eat that other stuff and drink. And I'm not going to rob places at closing time anymore. I'm just going to drink and rob places, you know. And I did get out of that mess. And I ended up shooting another cop later, and it's like, dang, man, this isn't going how I planned it. You guys did geographics, I didn't. When there's an indictment for you in a state, It's not geographic. You just moved to another state. You know, it's like looking after your own butt. It's not geographic. And, you know, that's before we had computers and all this. I get up to Nevada, and you know, they got 24-hour drinking up there. They got free booze in Nevada. You guys know about the free booze in Vegas and Reno and stuff, right? It's like you give them your paycheck and they give you free booze, that type of thing, you know? I thought, man, if a guy like me could have been born in Nevada, my life would have been different. This is where a guy like me needs to live. There's action going on, not in this little tiny hick town I grew up in. And you know, the second day I was there, I'm sitting in jail wondering, how the heck did they find out I got here so quick, you know? You know, and I tried living in Hawaii. You know, when I went to jail in Hawaii, I thought, at least I'm going to jail in a little higher class place, you know? And I moved to Mexico, and I lived down there a while, and went to jail there the first day I was there, and it's like, dang. But when I got out of jail, that, you know, it's like, I need to slow this down, you know, I got to go till I'm 21, and when I got out of jail, I thought, well, I'll get married, that's what I'll do. I checked with all seven girls I was engaged to at the time. In my life, more of everything's better. If you see how much firewood I got cut and split around my house, you would know that that's still true in my life. A little bit of firewood isn't enough. If my house caught on fire, it would probably, I don't think the fire department would be able to put it out. There's so much wood stacked around there. But this girl said she was pregnant. And so, you know, back then, you do the right thing and you marry her, right? And we had a Hell's Angel wedding in Reno, and it was an awesome wedding. You know, we got, you know, I've been married in the heart of Reno Chapel four times. I think they should have gave me a group discount there, but we got married, and we got her drunk and passed out, and we went out and did what we do, and I came back 3 days later to pick her up, and she was really pissed, and that girl, you know, I mean, you know, I'm a tough guy, right? I'm in the Hell's Angels, and that girl lied to me, you know, because that kid didn't pop out for 18 months, and it's like, man. And I don't know how you guys drink, but I, you know, I must get drunk, and girls must say, let's go get married. I must say, okay, because in a real short period of time after marrying the first one, I married four times, and I'm not divorced from any of them yet, and it's like... I don't know how the heck that happened, but it's like it's like when I came to in Reno, and I'm married to this fourth one, and she shows me a wedding certificate. You know, I just kept renting different houses and moving this wife in over here, and I, you know, I got my contractor's license as soon as I turned 18, and you know, I'm building stuff all over the state, and I'm always gone, and I'm hardly ever home anyway. So you just go stay with one wife for a while, and then another one, and. But this fourth one, man, you know, I hadn't been on my job sites. You know, I was building a shopping center, and I hadn't been there in a while, you know. I mean, man, I do not have time to go set up another house for this fourth wife, so I thought I'll take her home to the third wife. And I introduced them, and I bet you guys find this hard to believe, but they weren't getting along too good. And yeah, and so, you know, I hate that stuff. And so I told them I would be gone for 30 days, and I'll be back in 30 days, and they're going to have to either get along or one of them has to leave. And I got back 30 days later, and the third wife was gone, and I didn't like this fourth wife. So, and she would not leave. And so I paid three of my employees $50 a piece to tie her up in the recliner and put her on the flatbed and drop her off on the street corner and then go by and pick my girlfriend and her two kids up and move her in, and that's what they did, you know. And you know, in our book it says we all need a sex overhauling. Shit, I needed way more than that, man. So. You know, I'm going in and out of the institute, a lot of mental institutions. You know, a long time ago, for the violent crimes, send us to the psychiatric wards first, and they would evaluate us. And, you know, and the state wasted a lot of money doing that to me over and over and over and over again, because it came back the same evaluation every time. There's a place called Tascadero over in California. When it was originally built, it was for the violent, criminally insane. And I got to go over there right after it was built. And they called it observation. I was there 4.5 months. They observed me for 4.5 months. And we were so violent back then, they just kept us shot up with thorazine really, really bad. So we couldn't create no problems. So I don't know what there was to observe, because it was the same thing every day. We could smoke in the facilities back then. We weren't allowed to have matches or lighters. But so you would get up in the morning and you'd make it out to the day room and you'd sit and you'd start working on trying to get a cigarette in your mouth, you know. And somewhere through the day you'd get it, you know, and you'd get up, and they had this round indentured thing in the back concrete wall. Like, it looked like a cigarette lighter in a car, only it was glowing red all the time. And you'd shuffle up to that wall and you'd aim for that hole, you know. And when you thought you were lined up, you just fell forward. Yeah, I think that shit's funny, huh? It was irritating back then. The problem with that is if you missed a hole, you had to start all over again. But if you made it in the hole, it was really awesome. You went back to the day table and you just sat there. You couldn't smoke. You just watched it like this. And the ashes would fall down. And when it got to the end of the cherry and it fell down, and you just watched it, and you kind of spit the butt out of your mouth and went to bed, and it was all day. That took all day just to do that. And they observed me doing that for 4.5 months. And now that 4.5 months of observation, I was diagnosed incapable of adapting to society, way of life, and homicidal. And I don't know where they got that on that observation, but and think we gave up all that fun to come sit here in this room today. As a matter of fact, the guy that's one day sober, I want to tell you, people ask me all the time, they go, God, what's it like to get sober young and stay sober a long time, a lot of years like you are? And I'll tell you, when we were young and running around the young people's, doing the young people's things, and we're going to the different institutions and doing panels, and we're talking about what hot babes are going to what meetings and what times and what fellowships, and oh, we need to go over there and we need to go on this day because she'll be there. And now we go do a panel and we say, you know, who's seen the prostate doctor lately? And who's on high blood pressure medication? And oh, girls, we don't talk about girls no more. So if you want what we got, just... you know, and the courts started sending me the courts getting, they didn't send me, they offered me a deal. Because when I could tell you so many stupid, you know, when I drink, I do stupid stuff. Everything sounds like it should be the right thing to do when I drink, you know, I mean, whether it's stealing kangaroos or stealing armored trucks, you know, I mean, just, you know, things sound like a good idea. And, you know, I went to the penitentiary for some of that stuff, and you know, I joined the service, and I'm going to go to Vietnam, and you know, I first 10 minutes I was in the Army, I decided that was a wrong decision because I'm locked up there too, you know, and it's like, you know, and I'm the kind that cuts and runs, so, you know, I got a lot of escape charges on me, and, you know, and they do not understand, it's not escape, it's just, you know, I've slept for about 3 days. It's just time to go. You know, I got my energy back, and this isn't fun anymore. And so it got me into a lot of trouble. But so the judges make me this deal 2 years back at the penitentiary, or 1 year going to AA 5 days a week. And I couldn't make my mind up. That was too tough of a decision. So the judge gave me 5 days in jail to make my mind up. It's like, damn. I could have made my mind up just as easy at home as I could have sitting in jail, you know? And I didn't make my mind up till I went before him, and I decided to do that AA 5 days a week. And I took that year chip. I made it a whole year. I mean, it was 10 and a half months before I drank again, but I figured it was close enough for a guy like me, you know? And I proceeded doing it in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for a lot more years. You know, if you're new, you cannot get a better sobriety date than the one you have. I tried to get a better sobriety date for 12 years, and it got worse and worse, and I wanted to die. You know, you heard it from the speakers this weekend, the hopelessness we get into, the you know, we lose sight of anything being any different. And all those years going to Alcoholics Anonymous and going back out, it didn't work for a guy like me. You know, I'd get the sponsor, but not call him. I'd do the four-step inventories, but not be truthful about it. And I no matter what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous, I always drink again. I don't understand some people that drink and go to a meeting. I would never drink and go to a meeting. I would drink after a meeting, but not before a meeting. And I would take that other stuff that we're not supposed to talk about here and go to a meeting, though, and wonder why I had a hard time sitting down for an hour and a half, but... I'm not going to drink and go to a meeting, though. You know, I just kept going in and out of institutions and wives and getting locked up and seeing a lot of psychiatrists. And I don't know why psychiatrists, everyone I seen, though, the first one, first day, first thing they asked me, how's your sex life? So I'd ask them about their wives, and usually that was the last session I had with that one. And the courts would appoint me to another one. And you know, that was all based on fear. I can't be here more than one time because you might find out really that I'm afraid. And so that was like a defense for me. So nobody could find out that I was really frightening, because I'm this tough guy, construction contractor and convict and Hell's Angel. And I'm tough, you know. I you can't show like you care. I always, no matter who I was married to, there was times I wanted to go sit with them and watch TV, but you can't do that. Yeah, you know, I always had two couches. You stay over there, don't bother me. It's not comfortable laying on the couch with you. I wanted to desperately, but I can't let you in that close. You know, I've been going to AA for 10 years. I'm married to the seventh wife now, and we got the new baby boy, my youngest child that I was just talking about. And we got the pigs and the horses and the cows and the ranch and all that back, and the new Harley and the new Lincoln. She got, you know, that's how, if you want to go back with one of your wives, you know, but there's no way you're getting back, you just go buy a new Diamond or a new Lincoln, and they let you back in, you know, it's real easy. Cost me a lot of money through the years, all those wives, but you know, life really sucked. I wanted to die. The suicide attempts, the dramatic suicide attempts were already going on. You know, and my saliva glands are just screwed. They've operated on them a million times, but they still don't work right. And as a matter of fact, hold on a second. You know, when I ran her off and she wouldn't come back, it's like she called me. I'd been on about a week-long run. She said, I'm dating this guy. It's in a rock and roll band. He's going to be successful. We're moving to L.A. and you'll never get to see your child again. And I came up with another brilliant idea. I grabbed a shotgun. I stopped at 7-Eleven, bought two bottles of champagne. I'm going to blow her head off, and I'm going to take that baby. I'm going to run. Another wife's not going to do this to me. And I get over there and she's not home. Her neighbors knew I'd been locked up a lot and how crazy I was. And, you know, it just didn't matter anymore. I kicked the door and I'm waiting for her to get home. And the SWAT team shows up one more time. And I don't know why I couldn't go out and shoot another cop again. But I'm a tough guy, so I can't go out and say, hey, I give up. Let's go to jail. And I get to thinking, man, you know what? the world deserves what it did, what I did to them. You know, they're the ones that made me this animal. It's not my fault. And but my children deserve better. And I stuck the shotgun in my head and I pulled the trigger. And the next thing I know, I'm coming 2 months and months and months later, and I'm on these life support systems, and I'm strapped down one more time with leather restraints of every part of my body that would move. I didn't have no face. You could stick your fist inside my head. This is like thousands of surgeries later, putting me back together. It's like 87 major ones, like 10 to 40-hour surgeries. And I was all the way blind now. I'm still most of the way blind. This is really blurry here. But I'll tell you, being blind, there's a hell of a lot better looking women in the world today. And it sounds funny, but the reason is because I have to listen to you from where your heart's talking, not by the way you look. And so there is a beautiful, a million more beautiful women in this world than I really knew. The doctors would come in on a daily basis and tell me, boy, there's nothing we can do for you. You're going to die. And thank God for the service and action in Alcoholics Anonymous, because these people from AA one more time would come up to my hospital room and they'd knock on the door and they'd come in and they'd sit down. And I have this plate that pops in my head still. If I take it out, I still can't talk. So I couldn't talk, couldn't see, couldn't wiggle my head, couldn't nothing. And they'd sit down in the chair next to my bed and they'd ask me, could we read you the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? Like, I got a choice in this matter, you know. And they took shifts doing it all friggin' day long. And what they did was they brought this portable electric cassette player thing in, and these stacks of AA tapes. And when the last one would leave, they would put, they'd go, you want to hear AA tape? Like, I could say yes or no, you know. And they put an AA tape on, and the nurses thought I enjoyed it so much all night long. When the tape would end, they put one on. So over about the next 4 to 5 months, I listened to a million tapes all night long, you know. And God, you know, so desperately I want to tell you, you know, because my first meeting, they took me through the doctor's opinion back in 1975. And you know what? I believed that there wasn't a shadow of doubt that I had this allergy of the body and obsession of the mind. But you see, I didn't have no willingness to do anything different. You know, so what? It's a spiritual malady. I don't give a darn. So what if I'm in full flight from reality? You know, so what if I can't differentiate the true from the false? I mean, it really makes you want to keep reading, but it's like, who cares? You know, I want to die. You know, a guy in that first meeting said, if I ever take a drink again, I'll die. I went up after the meeting, asked that guy, I go, can we go try that? You see, so armed with all that information of my condition didn't do me any good, because I didn't want to live. You know, and I wanted to tell those people so desperately, you know, I know I'm an alcoholic, but you see, my case is different. I'm blind and I'm dying. See, anytime I can find one little thing different between me and you, I don't have to do what you do, so I can't stay sober, so it doesn't work for a guy like me. You know, because if I do what you do, it might work. So I couldn't do that. And over the next couple of years, I drank, you would think, you know, and I wrote to my family and stuff when I came out of that coma. You know, I cannot die, and I'll never take another drink or another drug as long as I live. You know, I meant that with every fiber of my body. And I drank over the next couple of years 4 more times. The last time, I saved all my pills up for my surgeries, and I took 455 synthetic morphine tablets, and I guzzled them down with 2 half gallons of vodka, and when I came to out of that coma, I was really pissed. You know, I pulled guns on cops and not pulled the trigger so they'd shoot me, and I come to out of the surgeries, I'm still alive. It's like, you know what, I don't want to die a little bit. I'm not crying out for help. You know, I desperately want to die. I mean, I'm trying everything in my power to die, and it just ain't happening. And when I came to out of that coma that morning, I got to thinking, you know what? You know, I never believed in God ever in my life. I believe what the book says deep down inside every man, woman, child is born the fundamental idea of God, and I believe that to be true. But I tried everything in my whole life to make you even believe there was no such thing as a God. And that morning, I thought, you know what? Maybe there is a God. And if there is a God, and if he's not done with me, there's nothing I can do to die. And you know what? A lot of people hear my tapes or CDs or whatever, and they'll call me up and they'll say, you know what? You screwed up my suicide attempt. I heard your tape, and if God's not done with me, I'm not going to die. I'm just going to keep missing body parts. And I tell them, you know, I'm just sharing my experience, strength, and hope. You heard it on a CD. You know, I'm not screwing up your suicide attempt, but, you know, the motorcycle wrecks and getting shot, and now, you know, bones have been transplanted. I'm all wired back together in pins and screws and all kinds of crap. And, you know, I've had muscle graft transplants, and, you know, my whole body's like a massive scar tissue. I mean, there's only one part left in original condition. I don't work them stuff, so I'll probably lose that sucker too. I've never said what part that is either. And you guys are so sick, you think. But that's not why I worked the steps. I made a deal with God that day, and it was a cussing prayer. And I believe that God understood it was the best I could do at the time. And I don't cuss in my prayers today, but it was the only way I knew how to at the time. And I believe God understood. And I made a deal with God that I would do whatever they wanted me to do it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't do it anymore. You know, when they ask that stupid question, I absolutely hate. You hear it all the time, or at least what you do in places I hang out and stuff. And they, you know, someone new, they say, "Are you done this time? Are you done yet?" And they asked me that, and I said, "No, I'll drink again." I really believed I would drink again. I mean, I hate that. If I could tell you if I was done, then I would be God. If I was God, therefore, I wouldn't need AA. I hate that saying. You won't find that in the book. That's my opinion. But I really believed I would. And I told them I would do whatever they said. And they told me, boy. They called me boy. And you know, I absolutely hate being called. I'm a hell's angel. I'm not a boy. My sponsor used to call me boy all the time. And I tell him, you know, stand still and keep talking so I can find you. And I'll whip your ass. You know, he laughed that little smart ass laugh, and then he'd move and it would really piss me off, you know, and I'd forgive him about what I was pissed off about, because now I'm pissed and I'm gonna find him no matter what so I could whip his ass. And I didn't know that he was trying to get me to focus on something different instead of what I was focusing on. But they told me, boy, go out and pick up the cigarette butts. And he's like, I ain't doing it, man. You guys are going to gather at the window. We're going to have a circus act. We're going to watch a blind boy pick up the cigarette butts. And he said, we thought you made a deal with God that you would do anything we asked of you. So, okay, gather at the window then. I'm going to go do it. And you know, it's been over 22 years. I still pick up the cigarette butts. I absolutely hate hearing old timers say, I don't do that crap no more. I leave that for the newcomer to do. I hope I never get there. As a matter of fact, I don't remember the gal's name. It was one day, so I'm sorry. But, you know, you're going to hear around here that you're the most important in this room. And that's true right after me, you know, because if one of us going to get drunk, I'd rather it be you than me. But... you know, and God hasn't sent me a fax and said, Matt, you picked up enough cigarette butts, leave that for the newcomer. He hasn't done that, so I still pick up the cigarette butts. You know, I go do this every weekend. I get home. The first thing I got to do is I got to empty all my pockets out of cigarette butts. And, you know, once in a while I forget, and I send them to the cleaners or throw it in the laundry, and man, all these cigarette butts are floating in the washing machine. And then they told me, boy, we need to go to jail. I was about 5 days sober, and it's like, man, I've been to jail a million times. I am not going down there. There's probably some unresolved issues there, too. At that time, they didn't ask for your ID or anything. You just walked up and said, hey, and they sent you in. And God, you know what? I definitely didn't carry a message of Alcoholics Anonymous that first night, because I'm so worried that they're going to find out I'm there and I'm not getting out of jail. And when I got to walk out that last locked door and it was my choice to leave, it was such a spiritual experience. I told him I would, then they told me that we need you to do that every week. It's not being covered. And I said, okay, 1 year, that's it. No more 1 year. And last February 1st was 22 years. I'm still going in the jail. You know, and you got to be careful what you pray for around here, too. We didn't have, I'd hear like Johnny Harris and all these people about the penitentiaries, the meetings they would take to the penitentiaries. And it's like, God, you know, I'm getting screwed here. We need some penitentiaries in our area so I can stay sober like these old timers did and stuff. And I should have asked for one or two, because I think we got 11 major facilities in our area now, and we can't even cover them all. There's all this farmland, and that seems to be the new place to build all these prisons. That is out in the middle of these huge agriculture farms, a million miles from anywhere, so if they escape, they ain't going nowhere. They might be able to eat, but they're not going to make it very far, you know? And I got, you know, me and another guy started all the meetings in the penitentiaries as they started up in the San Joaquin Valley, and I was doing that a lot, about 11 years sober, the state of California revised their security policy, and all of a sudden, I'm too high of a risk to go anymore. That pissed me off. Don't they know who I am? I started these goddamn meetings, and I got them registered with New York, and, you know, this isn't right. And you know, one more time, my sponsor had to be on my butt and said, God has another plan for you. And so I thought that meant get married. And you know, me and this girl, she was actually married when I first knew her, and we were a good friend, and she was in Al-Anon, and we're on conference committees, and we're doing a lot of things together, and she got divorced, and we're still friends and doing a lot of things together, and you know, it was, we had a lot of fun together, and it was convenient, and, you know, and I did care for her a lot, but I didn't love her. But, you know, I've been married 7 times before, and it's like, maybe that's what love is. It's never been like you hear on the songs. It's never been like you see on the movies. It's, you know, that's probably just a bunch of crap. This probably is love the way I feel for this girl. And I told my sponsor about it, and he goes, you know, I don't think so. You shouldn't do this. And I told him, you know what? I'm this big shot circuit speaker. I sponsor tons and tons of guys. I do all this stuff. I could make it work. Worst friggin' nightmare I ever had, you know. I mean, that's the way it ended up. And it, you know, don't get me wrong, it was fun and it was good for a couple of years. And, you know, she didn't want to do the program anymore. And it became a big fight, because I still wanted to go to meetings all the time. I still wanted to do this every weekend. And it just turned into be a big nightmare. And my sponsor kept telling me, you know, you just keep the fifth tradition going in your life, keeping this your primary purpose, no matter what. And you leave that marriage up to God, whether it works or it doesn't work. And, you know, I've done the marriage counseling a bunch. And I even did marriage counseling in sobriety, because I knew if I ever got married again, I wanted something to be different. And I don't know nothing about relationships. And we did it. You know, I asked her to do it, and you know, when the marriage started to fall apart, and we did it, and she didn't want to go no more. And I kept going, and you know what, it didn't work out. You know, and if you're new, you know, when I got sober, I'd hear these speakers, and oh, I got sober in 1943, and I came to A&A and put the plug in the jug, and life's been awesome since then. I'm thinking, man, what the hell am I doing wrong? I don't feel that way. I never, ever want to leave this podium with a newcomer in the room leaving you to believe that since I got sober, every day of my life's been absolutely wonderful. Because it hasn't been that way. I mean, it's been the best years of my life, don't get me wrong. But, you know, we got to feel crap here. We got to go through illnesses and deaths and your kids almost dying and doctors performing wrong surgeries on your kid. And you live in the hospital after hospital, and the guys you sponsor won't ever leave you alone, so you can't ever kill the doctor. And you know, and your parents die, and your aunts that you partied with because they're the same age as you, they die, and people you sponsor that are younger than you die sober, and you know what? That isn't fun. I've cussed God quite a few times in sobriety. I cussed him not too long ago. You know, being new, I want you to believe that you can have the most absolute awesome life. You can't even imagine how awesome it is. But you're going to go through hard times. You're going to, you know, that's why it's so important to make those phone calls every day, no matter what, to go to meetings and let them know how you're feeling, you know, what's going on, whether it's real or not, that's what we're feeling. And to have a group of people, a large group of people, man, you know what? Because, you know, I have guys do that, and they only want to call me, and they only want to share stuff with me, and I go, man, I'm gone all the time. You know, the book says we're to be put back in the mainstream of life. You need to get a group of people that you feel comfortable with, that you can share anything with. And I encourage my guys to do that, and all the people I sponsor. And you know, and you'll hear, if you're new, you'll hear it gets better here, to, you know, just go to meetings and get the phone numbers, make the phone calls, get in the service, get the sponsor, work the steps. And I'll tell you what my first year was like. I got indicted for income tax evasion for $543,000. Went back with my seventh ex-wife, and I've gone to the noon meeting, and she changed the locks on the door, moved her boyfriend in, and gave my Lincoln. I had emergency back surgery, millions of surgeries, and I got indicted for murder at 9 months sober. And I'm going to the meetings, and I say, yeah, if this shit gets any better, I don't know if I could take it, man. You know? You get involved in those steps, and you go through the inventory process, and to find out your character defects and why your life's so friggin', why we can't do anything in life and we're so maladjusted to life. And you get in the men's steps, and you find that daughter that you knew there was a kid out there. You don't know if it's a boy or a girl, and you call her up, and you have her mother lets you have an awesome relationship with her, and then her mother quits going to AA, and she commits suicide and sober, and your daughter thanks you for being a sober, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because of that, she has a father today. And you know, every time I think, you know what, I don't want to go get on this little model plane going to wherever we're at here. And I think about my daughter telling me that all the time, that because I'm an active, sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, she has a dad today. And how selfish and how self-centered would that be of me not to show up here in this wonderful place we're at here, where it's really beautiful and peaceful, and the people here are awesome. And you know, and then your daughter wants to get married, and she calls you up and she goes, Dad, would you walk me down the aisle? And you just cry like heck, and she goes, Dad, I'm sorry, you don't have to do it. And you tell her, honey, no, that's not it. You know, I'm just so blessed to have the privilege to do that. And then she calls you back the next day, and she goes, Dad, you know it's customary for the father to pay for the wedding. And it's like, shit. You know, I'm going on 12-step calls all the time. And we got a newcomer. We call it a newcomer condo with a shed we built out back and insulated and sheetrocked it. And we get guys over, and we put them back there. We finally, a year and a half ago, we put electricity in it. And we lock them in at night and unlock it at 4 o'clock in the morning and get guys sober. And you bring these drunks home, and we don't take them to detox centers. We take them home and we get them sober. And it's, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, you're tired, and your little boy that's 6 years old tells you, Daddy, it's okay, you go to bed, I'll finish. And you get up a couple hours later, and you come down the hallway, and you turn around the corner, and here's your little boy standing up in front of that drunk, still drunk on the couch, and say, dummy, if you just do this in the book, you'll stay sober. And you start crying and thanking God for the blessings he's given. See, it's not about all the money you get or the houses or whatever, because that's all gone in my life. I mean, I still have the house, but I don't know how much longer. You know, I just, this financial thing going on, you know, I'm the brokest I've ever been, except for when I was a newcomer, and I've never had it so good ever in my life. My children are involved in my life a lot. I'm an active member of my home group. My home group is Sierra Fellowship. We have 30-something meetings a week. That's the best fellowship there is on the face of this earth. I believe it is, and we're active in service a lot. We welcome newcomers a lot. You know, when I sponsor people, I get involved in their families. I don't just sponsor the person. You know, I get involved in with their spouses and their kids and stuff. And it's so awesome. And, you know, the only bad part about that is these kids get to know you. And I mean, it's awesome. They'll call me and they'll tell me, "Matt, we love you so much. And I just wanted to call and tell you thank you for keeping my daddy sober." And I get that over and over and over again. There's no amount of money in the world could buy that. You know, but the kids sometimes will call up and say, "Matt, can I ask you something?" I'm like, "Yeah, you know, you can, honey." And they'll say, "You know, I did this, and my dad or my mom, whichever one it is, said this was my punishment for it. Is that spiritual?" And, and I take the time to explain why, because I usually go over the punishments for the people I sponsor their kids. To not try to be too harsh, to try to be like a godlike person. How would a godlike person deal with this child? And so I get to talk to the children a lot. I get to be involved a lot. And there's times when you go speak out in the middle of nowhere and you bring all these halfway houses together and you talk to all these kids. And then a couple of days later, this 13-year-old boy comes up to the meeting at your home group, and he goes, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "No." He goes, "You just spoke to us a couple of days ago. How could you not remember us?" And I go, "If you remember," I said, "I'm blind." And he goes, "Oh, that's right, man, I'm sorry." And he explained that his parents had been killed in a car wreck when he was 2 years old. He's been in the foster system ever since, and he's been in and out of institutions and doing the halls. And he was going away to CYA for 4 years, and you know, he's drinking and used his whole life. And you know, he said, "You know what? He starts crying. And I go, "What's wrong?" He goes, "You know what? I don't own anything in the world. I've never owned anything. The only thing I own is this little turquoise necklace I made in the youth center." And he goes, "I've never wanted to live until I heard you." And he goes, "This is all I have to offer you for saving my life." And how much money could you couldn't buy that necklace? All the money in the world. If all you people put all your money together and tried to buy my little turquoise necklace, you couldn't buy it. If you want one, you got to go out and do what I do. You know, I've had so many experiences like that that show me that's not about making the money or having the best. You know, I do have the best looking house in the neighborhood, but it's not about having the best looking neighborhood. I was in the neighborhood, but, you know, and I didn't know how to do that. I knew how to rebuild a Harley, but I never owned a lawnmower, you know, and it's like, you change the oil on the Harleys on the front lawn, you don't have to mow it, you know. Asked my sponsor, "What are you doing?" He goes, "Watch your neighbors, see what they do." And they're out there watering the lawn, so I get out there like I know what I'm doing, I'm watering the lawn. Next thing I know, the shit grows. I ask my sponsor, "What do I do?" And he goes, "Do what your neighbors do." I watch them, and they start up this little contraption and go round and round and round. And damn. So I went and bought me a lawnmower, and I could not figure out how to get that lawnmower started. I had to ask my kid how to do it, you know. I don't remember why. Sorry, I need to stop, though. I don't want to go over the CD. You know, You know, when that divorce was over, it took 5 years for that divorce to get over in sobriety. And it's like, you know what? I love my life. It's just awesome the way it is. I love my grandchildren. My children are involved in my life. They come over on a daily basis. They call a million times a day. My kids share everything with me, too much information. You know, it's like, I do not need to know. No, I'm not going to tell that story in case, Jerry, in case you hear this CD. But my life's wonderful just the way it is. Running all over the country every weekend, going into institutions, you know, sponsoring people. You know, I constantly take two people through the steps, constantly. I never want to quit doing that. It's a pain in the butt, but the book says nothing else sure. Permanent, everlasting sobriety, or however it's worded, is working with others, and I try to do that every day of my life, no matter what. And I was up north in California, and you know, I always say I'm powder silver blonde because most of the girls in my life have been blondes, or there has been some brunettes in there, but blondes get me in trouble really bad, and they take advantage of me and stuff, and so I always say I need to be relieved from blondage, and I was being a smart ass speaking at conferences, saying, you know, I'm accepting resumes for my ninth ex-wife, and you know, I don't want a girlfriend, I don't want a wife, I don't want nothing. I love my life just the way it is, running all over the country, meeting you guys, and doing the deal with my kids and stuff in this little 98-pound, skinny, 5-foot-tall, of course, long blonde hair. Came up and told me she had a resume for me. And I went with a men's stag group from the area to dinner, and she took one of her sponsees that had a year of sobriety to dinner, and it ended up, we were at the same restaurant. And we talked that night, and for the first time in my life, I fell totally head over in heels with love with this little tiny girl. Those songs, I finally knew what the songs meant. I finally knew what the movies meant. I finally found out what the true meaning of intimacy was. I loved that girl with everything. We had an awesome relationship. And she loved Alcoholics Anonymous as much as I did, and she was totally involved in service and conference committees, and it was absolutely the most. She'd fly and meet me at places like this, and you know, I got to know her kids, and she got to know my kids, and it was just the most amazing thing that ever happened in my life. And this last Friday was 11 months ago she died. And I was gone. I didn't get a chance to get up to the hospital. See, I knew she was going in for a doctor's appointment. And he put her in the hospital that day, and 5 days later she died of melanoma cancer. And you know, I had to speak the day after she died. And I had to speak 2 days after she died. And you know, these are annual events. You know, the committee's worked on this all year long to have you guys a most awesome weekend this weekend. And some people told me, Matt, you need to cancel. You need to be there for the funeral. And I was pissed that the kids put it together that fast. 3 days after she died, to have the funeral. And you know, I'm up in this town, and there's a guy here from Sonora, and he apologized because he wasn't there, because he didn't show up for that deal I spoke at. But it was an annual event, and I told him, you know what, I have to keep my commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous no matter what. And a couple old-timers told me, this is different. You don't have to do that. You can bail this time. Oh, you don't understand. I can't do that. I wondered, yeah, if I was doing the right thing. When we get to Sonora, and there's, you know, me and my roommate were talking about, you know, in these old towns, they have old Catholic churches. I'm not Catholic, but and we looked, and they had this real huge, big red and white Catholic church, old. And I went in there and told the lady what was going on, and she asked if she could pray for me and Lori, and she did, and she wanted me to light a candle, and I was so shaky and crying, and I couldn't, and I asked her if she would light the candle for me, And that was the day of her funeral, and I was speaking that day, and when she lit the candle, I said, Lord, this is my goodbye to you. I can't be there, and I'll love you forever, because you see, the week before that, we talked for about an hour that no matter what, we were going to be in each other's lives, and we were going to be madly in love with each other forever and ever. And I didn't know it was only going to be for a short, another week. And I mean, you know, I've gotten through it to where I have a million awesome memories of that girl, and I'll always have that. And I thank God for the pretty bit. At first, I was pissed at God. It's like, you give me this, I finally find out what it's all about, and you take it away. You know, but what I've done is what I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got busier in AA. I took on more sponsees. I spoke more in the last 11 months than I normally do. And it's like, I was telling my sponsor a couple months ago, you know, I need a break, I'm getting tired. He goes, you need to do it till God gives you a break. And I believe I needed every part of this, every one of you people. Most of the places I've been in the last 11 months, I think you guys have done more for me than I've done for you. And I appreciate that. You know, I get it. I do get to carry these awesome memories, no matter if I ever end up in another relationship, if I ever find love again, no matter what. God's given me the joy of knowing what it's exactly like. You know, I heard Eva talk about the love of her life, and I understood what she was saying. I felt what she was saying. You know, a year ago, I was like, yeah, you guys met and went in the bedroom and lived together and split up, you know, that's love. But it's not that way. And I appreciate you guys asking me up here. Well, there's one guy here who told me Friday, he goes, Matt, you know, the last three conferences I've been to, you've been the Sunday morning speaker. I go, are you going to be there this Sunday too? And he goes, yep. And I go, damn, you're really sick, man. But I love all you guys so, so very much. And thank you for everything you've saved, that you've done for me in my life. And you've carried me this last 11 months and made my life absolutely unbelievable, happy and joyous. You know, in our 11th chapter says, great events will come to pass for you and countless others. And you newcomers, if you do what we do, no matter what goes on in your life, no matter how hard it gets, if you keep staying involved like we do, great events are going to pass in your life too. Thank you and God bless you.